From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
And I'm Eric Westervelt in Berkeley, California. It's Here and Now. The body of Queen Elizabeth II continued its journey across the United Kingdom today. Crowds lined up 13 deep and more to watch her casket travel through the Gothic streets of the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. Emma, while there was a lot of support in the streets today, Scotland's also home to a large and vibrant independence movement. For more, we turn to NPR's Frank Langfitt, who was in the crowd, and he joins us now to talk about all of that and more. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Eric.
So you saw the Queen's coffin pass by. Describe the scene for us today.
Yeah, you know, Eric, it was very moving. It was up the Royal Mile, which runs from the royal residence, it's Holyrood Palace, up these cobblestone streets through this old Gothic city. Spires and turrets and on the way up to Edinburgh Castle, and some people were waving Union flags out of windows. Children, the Queen's children, walked behind the hearse. King Charles was in his full military regalia, Prince Andrew in a black suit, and you could hear the hoofbeats of the horses. And so within about 15 feet of the prince, and he seemed a bit like physically weighed down by the heavy regalia, but it was very moving. And they went up to St. Giles Cathedral, and that's where the casket will remain for the next 24 hours, so people here in Scotland can pay their respects.
Frank, these are pretty large crowds. Is this just nostalgia, a sense of history? Why are people, you know, what are people telling you, why they're coming out here?
You know, a lot of it is absolutely history. You see a lot of kids in the crowd, of parents and grandparents have brought them. But there's also great affection. You know, she's the only queen that almost anybody, when you look across these crowds, has ever known in this country. And it's cliche to say so, but she was seen largely as the nation's grandmother. So there's, you know, people felt very close to her in a lot of ways.
As we mentioned, and as you've reported on a lot, there's a strong independence movement there. You know, what's the significance of starting the mourning process in Scotland?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. Eric, of course, she died in Balmoral, you know, her castle in Scotland. She loved Scotland very much. But there's also a political element here. You know, because of this push for independence, there's the government here wants an independence referendum next year. And I think there's no doubt this was a nice gesture to the Scots who support the Union. I was talking to a guy named John Steen. He's from Glasgow. He's very much a strong supporter of Scotland staying in the UK. And this is what he said.
I think with this procession today that this will quash a lot of the independence views and values, because people are turning out here to show their support for unity, for Britain and for our monarch, which is now King Charles III.
And of course, that may be a little bit of wishful thinking. I don't think this is going to make a lot of difference, but Steen is on to something. This was a nice gesture and a political one for Scots who are very loyal to the monarchy and the United Kingdom.
And Frank, King Charles spoke to Parliament for the first time today after making his first speech as king just a few days ago. What is your sense of how his new role as king is being received so far?
Well, there was some scattered applause when he drove in down the Royal Mile from the airport in his limousine. But clearly, people here are they're here for the Queen. We've reported before, King Charles is much less popular. That has a lot to do with his divorce from Princess Diana many, many years ago. People are concerned about his age. He's 73. I was talking to a woman named Norma Campbell, who was right next to me in the crowds. And I asked her a little bit about Charles, and this is what she said.
He's the same age as me, and I wouldn't like to be going out to work now.
Do you think that he's the right kind of age and personality for this job?
I'd like to have seen William taking over, somebody young.
What difference do you think that would make?
Just more enthusiastic.
And Frank, the King and Prime Minister.
I was talking about Prince William. Please continue, yes.
Well, I was just going to briefly, the King and Prime Minister are headed to Belfast, Northern Ireland. What kind of reception do you think we can expect there?
I think a very good one. I say that in Northern Ireland, there's great support for the monarchy. Remember, the Troubles, the Civil War, a lot of Unionists, very loyal to the United Kingdom, fought with the IRA to stay in the United Kingdom. So, and I've been up in Protestant areas, particularly almost called the Shankill Road, and there's a giant mural of the Queen there, which you wouldn't see in hardly any other city. So I think it'll be an extremely warm reception for him. And interesting that the Prime Minister is coming along, because, of course, none of this is supposed to be political, but every little bit, I'm sure the new Prime Minister thinks helps.
NPR's Frank Langfitt in Edinburgh. Thank you, Frank.
Great to talk, Eric.
In Jackson, Mississippi, the tap water is still not safe to drink. So we're listening to some of the dark brown water flowing from the tap of Mississippi Today reporter Molly Minta on Friday in Jackson. The water crisis is the result of flooding in late August when one of the city's two water treatment plants failed. So we wanted to check in on what's happening there today. State Representative Ronnie Crudup Jr. joins us now. He represents parts of Jackson. Representative Crudup, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, the question on everyone's mind, what are you hearing about when the water may be safe to drink again? And why is it taking so long to resolve this problem?
Well, we're not hearing an exact date right now when it will be safe. We're hoping within the end of this week, hopefully next week, that it will be fine. What we are hearing is that the pumps that failed, we got new pumps that's in now, and now the water levels are safe at a certain, you know, safe zone, their PSIs, and now hopefully they can start testing the water to see if it is safe to drink once they keep the levels, steady.
I see. So there's a boil water order. I'm wondering, though, if there's brown water, is boiling it going to make that safe? Are you hearing about a lot of brown water there in Jackson?
No, I'm not hearing about a lot of brown water. There are certain pockets where I think people in neighborhoods have brown water, but most of our water, even mine, because I was totally out of water for a few days early part of last month. My water is now clear, not necessarily safe to drink, but it is clear, and we do have good water pressure. But there are pockets in the city that does still have some brown water.
Right. Now, as we mentioned, this crisis was the result of flooding in August, which knocked out one of the city's two water treatment plants. It affects most a predominantly black city. And people are saying that this is also a case that involves environmental racism. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that. This is a part of town, even, 15 years ago, that was predominantly white. And so this is just just not being able to have the resource to fix the system, to fix the old pipes that are coming to this part of town. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily an environmental, racial issue. I think it's more of just a tax base that we don't have anymore to be able to fix these problems that are, result in our city not have the funding to fix this stuff.
Right.
And so I'm really hoping that, with the government, with state government, federal government stepping in, we will have more resources to make these things,
Yeah, I'm understanding that these water problems there in Jackson are not new. Last year, tens of thousands of people there were also without water for weeks. What has to happen long term, Representative, to solve this problem?
I mean, we need funding. That's a major issue. I mean, this year, thank God we got the ARPA fund that came in to start fixing on some of our pipes. But, we suffer from the same things a lot of, older cities suffer from, just old infrastructures in the ground that need to be replaced. And so we've been putting money into the streets, but not necessarily things underground, because that's just not a, I guess the sexy way to look at it, for politics. But we got to put money, these kind of resources in the ground to make sure that people have clean, adequate drinking water, not only for drinking water, but also for sanitation, to flush as well. So these are the things that we need the funding for, to fix, our old infrastructure from, drainage, from sewage, and just clean, drinkable water.
Right. What are you hearing from your constituents about this crisis? Because it can't be easy. I mean, you've got to remember to close your mouth every minute of every shower, and to always remember to use bottled water when you brush your teeth. I mean, I'm just curious what you're hearing from your constituents.
Well, it's frustrating because, like I said, we've dealt with this before. Last February and March, a lot of my neighborhood, we were out of water for 3 weeks, close to a month. And so to do this again, it's very frustrating. I have neighbors who said, hey, I'm moving. I'm going to buy a house somewhere else, or restaurants that are leaving. So it's definitely a frustrating thing, but we're doing the best we can to, make amends in the midst of it. Today we're having daily distributions of water here at our facility, throughout the city to give people clean water to use for brushing their teeth. But it's something you forget about.
Right.
You just kind of get in your old habits of doing those things, but you quickly forget to close your mouth or to, use bottled water. And so, it's a definite inconvenience, but we're making the best out of it as we can.
Are people there worried about long-term health issues that comes out of this crisis?
You know, I don't think anybody's worried right now, but I think people are going to look at this a little bit later on and try to figure out, okay, should I worry about what happened? Because, you know, at this point, people just wanted, you know, water just to be able to flush their toilets right now. That's one of the hardest things it is, to not be able to flush your toilets or not having enough to be able to, you know, take a bath and those things. We have pressure now, but now it's like, is it safe to drink? So I think those questions are going to come a little bit later down the road once people do have enough adequate water.
All right. Well, that's Mississippi State Representative Ronnie Crudup Jr. He was talking to us about the continuing water crisis in Jackson. Thanks for joining us, and best of luck to you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Officials in Washington, D.C. now have $10 million to help migrants who are being bused to the city from Texas. Washington's mayor declared a public health emergency last week, making that money available. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott has been busing the migrants north to Washington, D.C. and to New York City. Abbott says eastern cities need to deal with the disruption caused by the growing number of people crossing the southern border seeking asylum in the U.S. Murad Awada is the executive director of the New York Immigration Coalition. Here in Now's Peter O'Dowd spoke with him and asked how many buses are arriving in the city every day.
Well, it varies, but, you know, just the other day we had two buses, and before that there were about four, before that it was three and two, so it's not really easy to estimate considering Texas Governor Abbott isn't really coordinating with anyone when he is sending the buses.
And either way, it sounds consistent. I mean, they're coming just about every day, multiple buses. I understand you're often there at the Port Authority terminal in Manhattan to greet people as they get off the buses. What kind of condition are they in? How are they doing?
Folks are arriving to New York City at times having had little or no food, little or no water, having received no medical care.
Are you implying that they were put on that bus without any food or drink at all?
After we started complaining that they were being treated inhumanely without food and water, we saw Governor Abbott put out a video of the National Guard packing buses with MREs, which are military grade food that come in aluminum packaging, and some bottles of water. If I were in that situation, I would not eat that food either. And to also ask people to sacrifice food and water in a 2 to 3 day bus trip is actually incredibly harmful to the individual who just went through a really horrific process to just literally get to the southern border, to present themselves at the port of entry, to legally present themselves for asylum, and then to be treated this way is just inhumane.
New York is a sanctuary city. It's one of the few where providing housing, food, services to someone in this kind of situation, it's required by law. But there's now tremendous strain on the city's shelters. How overwhelmed is the system right now?
You know, I think that the piece here that's important to note is that while, yes, New York City is a sanctuary city, New York City is a right to shelter city. That we actually need a federal, state, and local response to this moment. Every person getting off of these buses has little more than the clothes on their backs and the paperwork that they were given. And, you know, we're going to continue to advocate to the city and state to improve access to housing, access to shelter.
Right. I mean, my understanding is that the amount of open beds is getting very, very low. Do people have places to go when they arrive in New York City?
The shelter situation that we're seeing right now is not a unique one. For over 20 years, we've seen a housing crisis in New York City. So you have folks who've been in the shelter system right now who've been there for months or even years. So the goal is to get folks, as many folks as possible, housed. But to answer your question directly, back in July, the mayor was given emergency procurement declaration by the New York City comptroller to expand the New York City shelter system. So there are shelters that are coming online to help with bed capacity in the city to ensure that everyone who needs a bed gets one. And, you know, the shelter system needs to improve, right? We want to fix the system and ensure that the shelter system is, in fact, just temporary and that people who are currently unhoused are given permanent housing in the very near future.
I think it's important for people to understand that the migrants who are arriving in New York City are here legally. They've applied for asylum. They are allowed to stay in the United States while they wait for their court cases to go through. That could take years, though. So in the meantime, what are the prospects for the people who show up in New York City with really no jobs, nowhere to live? Like, what's their life going to be like?
Well, the goal is to ensure that everyone who makes it here to New York City has the tools that they need to succeed in life. And the first thing that they need is actually shelter and making sure that they're able to get a bed in the shelter system. And then making sure that they have legal services to help them navigate the arcane and incredibly difficult immigration system that we have. And if they have children, that their kids were enrolled or are being enrolled on a rolling basis into school so that they can actually have access to educational services and also wraparound services in schools. This is an incredibly traumatic experience for many people, even more so for the youngest folks.
I know you strongly disagree with Governor Abbott putting migrants on buses and sending them across the country, but the truth is there is a record number of people who are crossing the border this year. There's a problem going on, and I wonder if you see any solutions out there that would solve the problem or ease the pressures at the border.
I think that the long-term solution here is really comprehensive immigration reform and ensuring that we're putting in a system that is fair, just, and humane, that recognizes asylum seekers, refugees, with fairness and gives them a shot at coming to the U.S. and being in the U.S. when they get here, and provided with the services that they need.
Murad Owouda is Executive Director of the New York Immigration Coalition. Thank you.
Thank you.
You may have heard about a lake or a pond near you that was temporarily closed this summer because of toxic algae blooms. These cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae, are caused by excessive soil nutrients and warming temperatures. These blooms can be dangerous. They can make people sick. They can even kill pets. And the only way to know if a bloom is toxic is to test, but not all states are routinely testing. As Harvest Public Media's Eva Tesfaye reports, in the Midwest, there are now private and volunteer testing initiatives.
What's our next point? North Shore?
North Shore.
Awesome.
Student employees from the Lilly Center for Lakes and Streams are headed out on Lake Wawasee in northern Indiana.
The water temperature is 25.7.
They are testing for algal toxins and the conditions that produce them. The Lilly Center has been testing lakes in Kosciuszko County weekly for the last 15 summers. It recently started sharing that information publicly so lake residents and visitors can swim, boat, and fish safely. The residents of Lake Wawasee love their lake, including Cindy Peterson. She takes part in the local conservation group and even offers up her boat to the researchers.
We're going to lose this lake. It's going to become a dead lake if we don't maintain it. And that's what they're doing with all this testing, is how can we make sure that doesn't happen?
But testing doesn't come cheap. The Lilly Center is entirely funded by donors, including the pharmaceutical Lilly family and the well-off residents of Lake Wawasee. Jed Harvey is in charge of the testing program.
Science is kind of tricky because you have to, often you have to follow the money, know where it's coming from, know to see even what gets done. But we're really blessed around here to be surrounded by a lot of people who really care about the lakes.
Thousands of dollars from these residents went towards designing a buoy that collects essential algae data in real time. Most lakes aren't as lucky. Funding is often limited for state algae testing programs. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management can only routinely test 18 swimming lakes that are managed by the state. Kristen Arnold is the chief of the Water Assessment Planning Branch.
We have a very specific goal of protecting public health at those swimming beaches, and that's how we kind of keep this program on a smaller scale.
Other states in the Midwest only test after a bloom has been reported. Lynn Milberg is with Missouri's Department of Natural Resources. She says there isn't enough funding to test regularly.
Our water quality monitoring group, they do not have any dedicated staff to do this. So whenever something comes up, you know, they have to find somebody that's available, squeeze it in between projects.
The Lakes of Missouri volunteer program takes on some of the burden. About 200 volunteers test 65 lakes across Missouri. Tony Thorpe, the program manager, says the group started testing for blue-green algae about 7 years ago. And he says the problem isn't going away.
If we listen to the climate science, it seems to indicate that this is only going to get worse. And, you know, water is a scarce resource.
The volunteer program, which is run by the University of Missouri and supported by various state agencies, only tests for algal toxins about 8 times a year. Thorpe says he knows there are lakes that need more testing. The situation in Missouri and elsewhere is exactly why Ann Schekinger of the Environmental Working Group argues states and federal governments should be doing more.
Any lake that's publicly accessible, that should really be the state or the federal government's job to do the testing, not the people who live on the lake. You know, it's a public resource.
Back in Indiana, Jed Harvey says that the Lilly Center's testing has been working really well for the lakes in Kosciuszko County. But the impact of climate change on blooms could make it difficult for local groups to keep up.
As blooms like this increase, it may be something where, in many places, the state will be needed to step up.
The state agencies and local groups agree that toxic algae is both an environmental and a public health issue that will only get worse as temperatures continue to warm. For Here and Now, I'm Eva Tesfaye.
The UN's Atomic Watchdog Agency wants a ceasefire around the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine have blamed each other for the shelling and fighting that puts the plant in danger. Now the International Atomic Energy Agency reports that the last reactor at the power plant has been shut down. For more, we're joined by NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfield. Jeff, thanks for coming on.
Hey, nice to be with you.
So this nuclear power plant is the largest in Europe. It's held by Russian forces and has been for months. The plant now seems to be connected to the power grid again. Talk about why they're now shutting it down.
So actually, this plant has 6 reactors, 5 of which had already been shut down, but they needed to be kept cool. And so what they'd actually been doing for the past few days is using the final reactor at the plant, unit number 6, to cool the other reactors because shelling had knocked out all the offsite power. Now, this is a pretty cool trick that they can do, but it doesn't work forever. There's a number of reasons they had to turn it off, including the fact that the plant just doesn't tolerate running at very low power like that. And so when they got offsite power restored, they took the opportunity to shut down that final reactor.
And some buildings near the plant 6 reactors have been damaged in the ongoing fighting. Talk about, you know, is a shuttered nuclear plant still dangerous? What are outside observers and the IAEA still nervous about here?
Well, that's right. Some very important buildings around the plant have actually had shells go right through their roof, including one that held fresh nuclear fuel and some radioactive waste. But the real concern here is the reactors themselves. So nuclear reactors are a bit more like cooking with charcoal, if you will. When you shut them off, there's still a lot of heat inside the reactor core, and you need to keep water moving through those reactors. So when there's offsite power, you can just move that water through. But if you lose it, you have to activate something else. They were depending on that one reactor for a while. Now they're going to have to rely on emergency diesel generators if they lose power again. And that's what people are worried about.
Jeff, so the plant is down. Does the region still need the energy from there?
Yeah, my colleague Kat Lonsdorf has been looking at this, and she's found that, well, the region does need the energy in the long term. In the short term, energy use is down, and so Ukraine should be okay without it.
Yeah, this is still a volatile situation, and remind us of the conditions inside this plant. We're hearing workers were operating under duress, essentially held hostage by Russian forces.
Yeah, it's a very tense situation by all accounts. You have these Ukrainian workers inside the plant, and they are being sort of watched over, I guess you could say, by Russian troops. There's also two IAEA inspectors in the plant trying to keep tabs on everything. And this was another reason they shut this reactor down. It's not just that the workers were sort of in this tense situation with the troops. It was they live nearby, and their nearby town had also lost power and water and sewage. And so the fear is workers were going to start leaving, and they just wouldn't be able to staff the plant.
Jeff, briefly, the IAEA is calling for a ceasefire in the area. What are the chances the sides can agree on some kind of safety zone around this plant?
Well, the head of the Atomic Agency, Rafael M. Grossi, was asked about that today, and here's what he said.
What I see is two sides that are engaging with us, that are asking questions, lots of questions.
But he said they didn't have an agreement yet, and there was still a lot more that they were going to need to work through before they could create a safety zone around the plant.
NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfield. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
Nearly 50,000 students in New York, concentrated in Brooklyn and the lower Hudson Valley, are going to schools that offer almost no English, math, science, or history, despite nearly $1 billion in government funding over the last 4 years. These are schools operated by the ultra-Orthodox Hasidic community. Religious instruction dominates the day, and secular subjects are squeezed in as an afterthought. That's among the findings of an investigation from the New York Times based on some 275 interviews. Eliza Shapiro, education reporter for the Times, participated in the investigation and joins us now. Good to have you, Eliza. It's quite a piece you've written. Thank you.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me.
So you begin with a portrait of one of the largest private schools in the state, over 1,000 boys, and all of them failed the state's 2019 standardized math and reading exam. Extraordinary finding. And that finding wasn't an outlier. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, you know, to really paint a portrait of what's going on in these roughly 100 Hasidic boys yeshivas, obviously, you know, we did a lot of reporting, and one element of our reporting was to look at test scores. You know, as an education reporter, I know that test scores never tell the full picture about any school or any, you know, group of schools. But here we found over and over that the Hasidic boys' schools that did take standardized tests did, you know, exceptionally poorly, were some of the worst performing schools in the entire state. You know, and for context, I should note, many of the Hasidic boys' schools do not take standardized tests at all, so it's hard to know, you know, how they would do. But we spoke to about 36 teachers who have taught in these schools, and we really heard, a very, very similar stories from those teachers about how little their students knew, particularly in English and math.
Yeah.
And to
Eliza,
paint that picture.
Yeah. And Eliza, you say this isn't happening by design. So can you tell us more about these schools? What does a typical day look like at a standard boys' school in this group of schools, these yeshivas
Yes.
in these communities?
Absolutely. So yeah, we did find that sort of the failures in the secular studies part of the day really are happening by design, because the purpose of the schools is to do something very different than a typical public school. It is not to teach, you know, robust English, reading, math, civics, science, social studies. It is to focus, you know, largely, in some cases almost exclusively, on studying Torah and Talmud and these, you know, foundational, very, very important religious texts. And, you know, some defenders of the yeshivas will say, and we certainly found this in our reporting, I mean, the boys are in school for hours and hours, you know, poring over these texts, understanding the complex legal principles inherent in them. I mean, some boys arrive at school before the sun rises and they leave when it's dark. But what they're doing is they are participating in religious instruction. And often what they're doing very little is anything by way of secular.
Right. The secular curriculum is squeezed into under an hour or so a day, We're also talking about highly censored content, right? Can you talk about what's not allowed to be taught in the secular curriculum?
Yeah, there's a fair amount that really is sort of off limits in many of these schools. I mean, we showed some censored textbooks to give a sense of that. But, you know, the many, many students we spoke to, former students, I mean, there is little, if any, discussion of biology, the reproductive system, evolution, very, very little in most schools that we're talking about, you know, civics, government, history. You know, what we really found and what we heard over and over again was that a connection to the outside world, a connection to the modern world, can really be seen as a threat by the leaders of the schools.
Yeah.
And so very little of what would connect these students to the world outside is actually provided in the schools.
So, Eliza, how is this being allowed to happen? Because, of course, we haven't sort of stated the obvious here. We're talking about public education dollars, right, going into these schools. How is this being permitted?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, again, these are private schools, private religious schools, and it's true that, you know, public tax dollars help fund all kinds of private schools, which is, you know, perhaps its own debate. But what we found here is really an extraordinary amount of government funding going towards these schools, as you said, over $1 billion in the last 4 years alone. The schools, you know, have sort of looked to a number of programs that they receive money from. I mean, they receive money from Title I, which is aimed for, obviously, you know, schools with a lot of kids who are in poverty. They, you know, one of our findings was they get a relatively small but still, you know, meaningful amount of money for internet-related services, even though the students are barred from using the internet, because that, again, is a connection to the secular world. The schools, many of the schools rely on vouchers, childcare vouchers, right, to help pay the tuition. So there's sort of this broad array of government programs that the schools have tapped into to, you know, and the result is that they really rely on taxpayer dollars to function.
Right. And I'm curious about the legal requirement to educate these children. And there have been complaints, but so far no action. What have you heard from New York City Mayor Eric Adams and Governor Kathy Hochul? What are they saying?
Yeah. So just this morning, both the mayor and governor were asked about the findings of our investigation. We obviously asked both of them before as well. I was particularly struck by the governor's response. Just about maybe 2 hours ago, she said, you know, asked about our findings, said, people understand that this is outside the purview of the governor. So that was sort of a moment of deflection. New York has all these complicated rules of who governs the education system. And it's true the governor does not have direct oversight over the state education department. But the governor is obviously the most powerful person in New York. And needless to say, has a fair amount of purview over the state schools. Mayor Eric Adams was also asked this morning about our findings. He said he was not concerned about the findings of the investigation, but he also said, and this is an important nuance, that his administration would restart this very long-delayed investigation into some of the Hasidic schools in New York City. So we are waiting to hear more about that.
Now, you also reached out to many of the schools that you reported on, but the administrators didn't want to answer your questions. But some Hasidic groups preemptively responded when they were informed about your reporting. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, so we received a wide range of responses that we really, really tried to get as comprehensively in the story as possible. I mean, one of the responses that I want to highlight is, you know, this is about parental choice. These are parents who are choosing to send their children to schools that focus on religious education, and that is the choice of the parent. I think, which is a you know, an interesting argument that I'm interested to hear more debate on as the city and state think about this issue. You know, obviously, I think we're also interested in children's rights. I mean, what we have found is many of the boys and men who graduate, so to speak, from Hasidic yeshivas struggle to make a living, struggle to certainly make a life for themselves in the world outside if they choose to leave the community. So, you know, I think it's a really compelling and strong point that we tried to emphasize, that parents do not want a typical secular education. They want something different. But then, of course, you get right back into, so what is the government's role in funding these schools then?
Right. I think one of the things, well, there were a lot of things that I was really struck by in this piece. Among them, some of these schools impose corporal punishment on kids. But Eliza, in the sort of 30 seconds that remains, what surprised you most from this investigation?
Yeah, many things. I would say, just to your note, I was not expecting when we began this reporting that so many of the nearly 300 people we spoke to would say that they or their children experienced corporal punishment. That was a shock to me.
Yeah.
I think it was a shock to the elected officials involved, and that is something we're going to continue to look into.
All right. That's New York Times reporter Eliza Shapiro talking about her extensive investigation into acidic education in New York. Eliza, thank you so much.
Thank you.
About a third of Americans say that because of the COVID-19 pandemic, they are more likely to buy life insurance. But do you actually need it? Here with her take on what to consider when shopping for life insurance is Jill Schlesinger. She is a CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, always great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
So the whole point of life insurance is to provide financially for your loved ones if you should die. Tell us why it's important and who should consider it.
Well, I mean, look, it's important if people are relying on you. So if you're a single parent, that's, you know, a pretty good sign that you probably need some coverage. But there are a lot of other situations where life insurance could be a important component of your financial plan. For example, let's say that you have a spouse who also works, but you make a lot more money, that you're providing more of a boost to the household. Let's say that you're still taking care of maybe older parents who maybe had a big rough time in the financial crisis, never quite recovered. Maybe you have a special needs child whose needs will continue well beyond your lifespan. Mm-hmm. So these are all the kinds of people who answer yes to the important question, if I were to die now, would anyone endure financial hardship?
All right. So let me ask you about two kinds of life insurance, and I'll tell you a little bit about my situation. So I'm an older dad. I have a younger kid. He's 11 years old. I was told at a certain point, buy a whole life insurance policy. And then someone came to me a few years later and said, no, you need term life insurance. Can you sort of explain those two kinds of life insurance?
Absolutely. So these are sort of the two big categories of coverage. And term is really the more common because I would say about 95% of insurance problems are met with term life insurance. And it is what it sounds like. You have coverage that is in place for a certain period of time. The other kind of insurance that's out there is called permanent. Permanent life insurance is actually in force for your entire life. The question is, how many people really need coverage for their entire lives? Now, maybe someone sold you that coverage because they said, hey, look, you're an older dad, term is going to be a lot more expensive. But there's also that idea that in 10 years, when your kid is sort of grown up and on their own, well, you may not need coverage at all. So the hope is that you have the coverage that you need for a specific period of time, unless you need it for, say, estate purposes, a special needs trust, or maybe you've got an illiquid business that you need help creating liquidity if you were to die suddenly.
Right. Okay. So let me ask you another question. I'm reading that more than 100 million Americans are living in a life insurance gap, meaning they don't have sufficient coverage. Why is that happening, and how should we think about that? In other words, what is sufficient coverage?
Well, I mean, I think the reason is that, number one, it is not pleasant despite me doing this on a Monday with you to start your week, to start talking about death. This is why they call me Buzzkill Jill. So it is not a pleasant topic, and I understand that. However, the gap usually occurs because your life changes and you don't adapt your insurance to meet those changes. So it may be that you had one child when you first got your policy, and then 5 years later, you have another child. Or maybe it is that you made a certain amount of money at the age of 28, but your lifestyle has changed dramatically and you need more insurance. To cover the need, I think it's first and foremost important to go and make sure you've got enough coverage in place, tons of online calculators to do that. And then you've got to figure out how to buy the cheapest insurance that will fulfill those needs. A lot of times, by the way, big employers often add this benefit where you can buy life insurance, extra insurance beyond the standard amount, and that insurance you can take with you if you leave the organization. Otherwise, you know what? There's a number of different term life insurance websites, aggregation sites, and companies that can help you out. Just get the coverage you need. If anything, especially if you're younger, getting that coverage now, a little bit more than even you think you need, is probably wiser than rolling the dice and hoping for the best. Let's plan for the worst, and then we can get that covered and move on to your next financial goal.
Finally, I want to ask you this. One of our producers recently had a baby, and she keeps getting postcards in the mail for something called baby life insurance. This is something I've never heard of. You call that a no-no. What's the deal with that?
Well, this is an old insurance sales technique that is just silly, because what some insurance salesperson is going to say is, oh, you've got to insure the insurability of your kid. You must get coverage now. This is a waste of your time. This is a waste of money. Go rip up that little solicitation and do not pass go. There is no reason that, remember, what's the key question? Would anyone endure a financial hardship if I were to pass away? Obviously, an infant or a child would not fall in that category. So that's a hard no. Bye-bye.
All right. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. No way she is a buzzkill, even when she's talking about life insurance. Jill, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
And I'm Eric Westervelt in Berkeley, California. You're listening to Here and Now.